Good morning, this is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, February 13th. If you were optimistic these days, especially about the direction of the United States, the fate of the European Union currency experiment, or some kind of favorable resolution to the rapidly developing Iranian crisis, and all the offshoots from it, then you're a better man than me. I see zero reason to be optimistic about much of anything these days, to wit. In Europe, specifically the 16 nations of the 27-nation European Union that use the euro currency, they are trying to come to grips with a debt crisis in Greece, and a government in Athens that flat-out lied until recently when confronted about its debt levels. Debt? What debt problem? Greek officials would say when asked just where they stood. Then they finally fessed up and offered, oh, I guess you'd like to know our debt is 12.7% of GDP. Seeing as how the Euro nations are supposed to limit their budget deficits to 3%, this created a bit of a dilemma, especially when the likes of Portugal, 9.3%, and Spain, 11.4%, are in a similar mess. So EU leaders got together this week and on Thursday issued a statement. We fully support the efforts of the Greek government and their commitment to do whatever is necessary, including adopting additional measures to ensure that the ambitious targets set in the stability program for 2010 and the following years are met. We call on the Greek government to implement all these measures in a rigorous and determined manner to effectively reduce the budgetary deficit by 4% in 2010. Now, nothing on what exactly the EU will do other than give Greece a hearty pat on the back, because as I've been writing, there is no mechanism in place for dealing with such a crisis, and to just bail Greece out injects the moral hazard issue, whereby if you rescue the Greeks, it only encourages bad behavior on the part of the others. On the other hand, if the International Monetary Fund got involved, the IMF being the usual rescuer of last resort in these situations, it would imply that the EU can't handle their problems themselves, and thus why would you consider the euro currency any differently than that of, say, Ukraine, an IMF beneficiary. The problem is Germany, Europe's largest economy and the country that was also most resistant to a single euro currency in the first place, save for Britain, which remains outside this part of the EU club. Germany just reported that its economy stagnated in the fourth quarter, unchanged, surprising the experts, and Chancellor Angela Merkel has a ton of political issues to address. She wouldn't be allowed to throw Greece a life preserver even if she wanted to at this point, so Merkel was forced to say after Thursday's meeting, Greece will not be left on its own, but there are rules, and these rules must be adhered to. So on Monday, when Eurozone finance ministers meet, it is hoped more details will emerge on just how the EU will aid Greece while the Greek government deals with a populace that has been spoiled rotten with outlandish pay raises in just the past few years. Now their leaders are calling for givebacks. Ain't gonna happen, say the workers. Let's strike. Martin Wolf, Financial Times. The financial crisis of 2009 is morphing into the fiscal anxieties of 2010. This is particularly true inside the Eurozone. The risk has emerged of a self-fulfilling confidence crisis that would have dire consequences for other vulnerable members. Much attention is focused on what might happen if the crisis were not resolved, with talk of bailouts, defaults, or even exits from the euro. But what would need to be done to resolve the crisis without such a calamity? It is the demand, stupid. Conventional wisdom in the Eurozone is that the crises are the result of poor policymaking in peripheral countries. In particular, fiscal policy has been too loose and the economy is too inflexible. The wages of such sins are austerity. Then, after a lengthy penance, the lost sheep returns to the fold of stability. The conventional wisdom also declares that once fiscal adjustments have been made and flexibility introduced, the affected economies can return to growth. This conventional wisdom is, alas, nonsense, says Martin Wolf. Until policymakers recognize this, they are dooming the Eurozone to huge tensions. Theirs is not a problem that can be resolved by fiscal austerity alone. They need a huge improvement in external demand for their output. So what is to be done? If the aim is to avoid disaster, the answer is temporary fiscal support for the struggling countries, robust aggregate demand in the Eurozone as a whole, and a substantial rebalancing of that demand led by Germany. The fiscal support would be designed to prevent a short-term confidence collapse from triggering a default. In return, weak countries would need to commit themselves to falling nominal wages in a program of fiscal retrenchment. Alternatively, The vulnerable countries could be left to dangle in the wind, but a currency union whose core country not only exports deflation but also stands aside as members collapse is in deep trouble. Germany alone can decide whether it wants this union to prosper or not. That was Martin Wolf of the Financial Times. Anatole Kaletsky, London Times. The worst news of all is that the extreme deflationary policies now being imposed on the weakest Eurozone countries point to frightening implications. The Greek and other Club Med governments, Club Med governments, another name for the pigs, ex-Ireland, can slash their deficits only at the cost of huge falls in economic activity. Without the possibility of devaluation, they cannot hope for big export gains, nor even for the capital inflows that have helped to end the slump in British property. Instead of the broadly Keynesian policies that have helped to revive growth not only in America and Britain, but also in Germany and France, these weaker members of the Eurozone are pursuing measures that are almost guaranteed to prolong and deepen their recessions. And now, to make matters worse, Germany is planning to cut its own budget deficits and to rely for the next phase of its recovery on export-led growth, which can only mean crushing even more Club Med businesses unable to compete against German goods. That was Anatole Kaletsky of the London Times. Oh well, as the dollar soars against the euro, at least European exporters benefit from the cheaper currency, which has been their big complaint. But what of the United States? Are we really any better off despite the confidence expressed in the greenback? As the Geico commercial puts it, does a 10-pound bag of flour make a really big biscuit? Michael Boskin, Wall Street Journal. President Barack Obama's 2011 budget lays out a stunningly expensive big government spending agenda, mostly to be paid for years down the road. On average, in the first 3 years of the 10-year budget plan, federal spending rises by 4.4% of GDP. That's more than during President Lyndon Johnson's Great Society and Vietnam War buildup and President Ronald Reagan's defense buildup combined. In those same years, spending on average hits the highest level in American history, 25.1% of GDP, save the peak of World War II. The average deficit of $1.4 trillion, 9.6% of GDP, is over three times the previous 2008 record. Remarkably, President Obama will add more red ink in his first 2 years than President George W. Bush, berated by conservatives for his failure to control domestic spending and by liberals for the explosion of military spending in Iraq and Afghanistan, did in eight. In his first 15 months, Mr. Obama will raise the debt burden, the ratio of the national debt to GDP, by more than Reagan did in 8 years. The deficits are so large relative to GDP that the debt-to-GDP ratio keeps growing and then explodes as entitlement costs accelerate in subsequent decades. Ken Rogoff of Harvard and Carmen Reinhart of Maryland have studied the impact of high levels of national debt on economic growth in the U.S. and around the world in the last two centuries. In a study presented last month at the annual meeting of the American Economic Association, they conclude that, so long as the gross debt-to-GDP ratio is relatively modest, 30 to 90% of GDP, the negative growth impact of higher debt is likely to be modest as well. But as it gets to 90% of GDP, there is a dramatic slowing of economic growth by at least 1 percentage point a year. The likely causes are expectations of much higher taxes, uncertainty over resolution of the unsustainable deficits, and higher interest rates curtailing capital investment. The Obama budget takes the publicly held debt to 73% and the gross debt to 103% of GDP by 2015 over this precipice. Such vast debt implies immense future tax increases. It's hard to imagine a worse detriment to economic growth. It was Michael Boskin. Back to Kenneth Rogoff. In a story by Peter Coy of Bloomberg Businessweek, Coy writes, in an interview, Rogoff says investor confidence is more of a concern now than it was in another high debt period following World War II. Wartime expenditures come down easily, plus you have a huge labor force you can absorb, which boosts growth. This time around, the U.S. has neither advantage. There's no easy way to cut spending, and the economy doesn't seem capable of absorbing the huge mass of unemployed. So, says Rogoff, it's much harder to convince markets, as Obama will learn, that you really mean business. Which leads me to spending. Last Saturday, I wrote of the Tea Partiers ask them if they're willing to give up any of their entitlements, and then we'll talk, because that's what needs to be done in this country before we officially break the bank. The next day on Meet the Press, former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan noted that what is depressing these days is that, quote, spending is untouchable. That's the bottom line, folks. If you aren't depressed yourself by this, then you're living in a dream world. Our political process is dysfunctional, our leaders refuse to face facts, and we, the people, are just as culpable. Incredibly, some talk of revolution, but then follow the likes of Sarah Palin. I noted a few weeks ago that I'm astounded when I hear people say they just want ordinary Joes and Janes in government instead of the garbage we have today. I counter, I've always believed in American exceptionalism. I want exceptional people, like our founding fathers leading this nation, but instead we've had a series of disappointing presidents at a time when we can least afford them. There are ways to fix the entitlement mess, such as a one-year freeze on the level of benefits and a hike in retirement age, in the case of Social Security, but with the exception of our military, our nation is largely comprised of a bunch of selfish wimps. Robert Samuelson, Washington Post, there is no way to close the massive deficits without big cuts in existing government programs or stupendous tax increases. Suppose we decided to cover all future deficits by raising taxes. Taxes would rise in the 2020s by roughly 50% from the average 1970 to 2009 tax burden. That's the gut of it. At age 65, average Americans live for another 18 years. Government now subsidizes each of them an average of about $25,000 a year, almost $14,000 in Social Security and $11,000 in Medicare. We cannot sensibly afford all these subsidies without oppressive tax increases, deep cuts in defense and other programs, or immense budget deficits that someday might trigger another financial crisis. Bond buyers might balk at swallowing so much government debt. By the administration's estimates, that publicly held debt, the accumulation of all annual deficits, balloons from $5.8 trillion in 2008 to $18.6 trillion in 2020. Robert Samuelson continues, we can no longer just tinker. We need to ask whether government spending serves genuine public purposes or merely benefits favored constituencies. Delay in acting has already eliminated a long grace period to prepare for reduced retirement benefits or to wind down useless programs. The politics of procrastination is bipartisan and rests on shared assumptions that the public won't stomach hard choices, that we don't know whether large budget deficits will reproduce a crisis or when, and that, therefore, the easiest political course is to dawdle and blame the other party. But this self-serving inattention, coupled with much larger deficits, is tempting fate. If investors lose confidence in Treasury bonds, they would demand much higher interest rates. The ensuing crisis would almost certainly compel abrupt spending cuts and tax increases that would make today's choices look gentle. It was Robert Samuelson. So between the United States and Europe, there's a critical need for true leaders and people willing to sacrifice. I see neither. Markets will continue to go up and down, and we may yet have another great year or two. Not in 2010, though. But the long-term trend is now down. And I haven't even mentioned the severe budgetary issues some of our major states face, similar to Greece, or the kind of geopolitical events that could sap confidence far worse than 9/11 did. Now, who wants a beer? Well, stocks broke their four-week losing streak, though it sure didn't feel like it, as the Dow Jones added 0.9% to close at 10,099, while the S&P 500 gained an equal amount and NASDAQ rose 2%. Retail sales for January at the bigger chain stores rose 3%, while overall retail sales rose 0.5%, ex-autos for the month, a decent number. I'll be back with you next Saturday. Enjoy the long holiday weekend. Have a great week.